Hello and welcome. I'm Robin Childs.
I'm Corey Childs.
And I'm Matt Parker.
Together we form the MoCo Expedition, three good friends exploring the mysteries of storytelling craft. You may be familiar with Pixar's 22 Rules of Storytelling. As part of an ongoing series, every other episode we'll be exploring one of these 22 rules. You'll hear our connections, objections, exceptions, examples, and things you might not have considered when you first sat down to apply these principles. In today's episode, we'll be exploring rule number one. You admire a character for trying more than for their successes. So grab your writing notebook, put on your best adventurer's cap, and welcome to the MoCo Expedition.
I had a couple thoughts on this. My first one is very, very near and dear to my heart. I'm very much a child of the 80s, and I think this is exemplified in no greater way than in the 80s-style sports montage. Basically, just a long trial and tribulation of people failing, slightly getting better each time, and by the end of it, you can see that they can achieve what they'd set out to do.
So it almost kind of shortcuts the process, because then you cut directly to them kind of succeeding. I mean, we know that they're going to succeed in a lot of ways, and there's always a trial, but that sort of trying montage is sort of to make us feel like they've earned it.
See, and that's why my first thought when you said that was that I think that that's actually a really cheap way of doing it, because it's almost like, I could show this, I could show actual struggles, but instead I'm going to pay a washed-up pop band to give me 3 minutes of classic music and then show somebody punching meat to stand in for actual trials.
I think that, there's a reason why the trope really isn't used anymore, and that's a big one. I think it has its flaws. That said, it's the first thing you think about when you think about a Rocky film. And those endure. Yeah. So I think they have some intrinsic value. The issue is they got copied and watered down, and eventually they became a little too self-referential.
Well, I mean, I think that's worthwhile to think about. When does something like a trying montage work, and when does it fail? Because usually the reason that a lot of these conventions go out of style is one part that people get used to seeing them, and the novelty wears off, but also that they get used poorly, and they get used poorly enough times that people actually can't see a good one when it comes up.
That would be my question. Is Rocky, to you, Corey, the best example of it? And if not, what is to you the best training montage?
Rocky isn't, I don't think, the best example of a training montage. It is, however, the first. In that
is
it's
it?
The first one that popped into my head. It's probably number one in terms of pop culture popularity.
So it's most iconic.
Yeah. I guess it's had the most impact on the pop culture in general. I don't know. It's been a long time since I've seen a good montage-y film. I'm also always partial to Karate Kid.
Yeah.
That's just classic.
The original one.
Yes, absolutely.
I want to make sure to come in and preface that.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen the latest one, partly on principle, being a lifelong karate aficionado myself. But in terms of storytelling, I probably should.
According to the internet, the prototypical training montage, what set the precedent, was a movie called The 36th Chamber of Shaolin, a Shaw Brothers Kung Fu film from 1978.
That's kind of fascinating. That sort of, I've never heard of that, but that's where it sort of debuted and then got reincorporated.
Well, I think that that's pretty common. I think that these things that come up in movies, these ideas, the first one that does it is normally not the one that we know the most about, I feel like, because I think sometimes they percolate up through, I don't want to call them the farm teams, but they percolate through less well-known media that really avid consumers, like directors and writers, see, and then they adapt that to their work. So I think that we probably have a lot of things where we know the second or third or most iconic that can be traced back to this first thing that we've never heard of.
The Tipping Point talks about that a lot, and it's kind of the idea that there's the inventors, and there's the early adapters, and then there's sort of this middle phase where people look at what the product is, they figure out how it does and doesn't work, and then they sort of fine-tune it and make it into something that works for a larger audience, because often the original idea is not accessible to a lot of people.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that, and I'm glad that someone else came up with that, because it saves me from having to write this whole thing and getting famous. Lucky me.
That's interesting that you kind of mentioned that with the early adopter thing. Also, according to the internet, the concept of bullet time, which we know was popularized by The Matrix, is actually an incredibly old film technique. It looks like it's like from that original picture where they have the horse galloping, and then through that camera technology, you see that there's a point where its feet are never on the ground. That, yes, apparently is the origin of kind of how that worked, but people were using bullet time-like effects throughout the 80s, and it was particularly popular in music video.
Huh.
Interesting. See, and that, yeah, there is definitely, I think, a moment when something becomes popular, and then, like Robin said, is no longer popular because either it's overused, like bullet time was, by everyone in the 2 years after The Matrix, or I think sometimes it can be because it is used so perfectly well in one thing that other examples kind of fall by the wayside.
It actually gets people basically go, no one can top that, and then they quit trying. That's
right,
kind of what you're saying.
One does it so perfectly, and that leads into the pale or poorly done imitation, where in retrospect, nothing quite lives up to that ever again. But people keep trying, but they just can't reach that milestone.
To kind of bring it back to the main topic, do we feel like that sort of thing with the montage? Well, obviously, it kind of has lived through its time. Do we feel like that's, as a whole, this we appreciate characters for trying, is that universal, or is that something that's going to become played?
See, I've been thinking about that. That was the angle that I approached it, because I was going, well, what are the exceptions to this rule? And I think that a lot of superhero characters are the exact opposite of this, especially in their original incarnations or earlier incarnations, where it was just sort of like, there's the bad guy, here's the good guy, you know how this is gonna play out, you're not really concerned at any time, and there's no real trying. It's more like, here's a problem, here's my suggested solution, it works.
And the suggested solution is always punching people in the face, which I'm okay with.
Or, you know, turn back time by spinning around the earth. Whatever works.
And what's funny is, because I have written down as a great example of a little bit of a change to this rule, or a better illustration, is Batman, but in kind of the modern understanding of Batman. I think he really illustrates almost a codex to this rule.
Okay, how so?
Batman is the world's greatest detective, and is a ninja, and is a billionaire. And if it gets a lot easier than world's greatest ninja billionaire, it's pretty hard to find. But at the same time, he is always struggling, because his goal is not punch this turkey in the face, as Kevin Smith says. His goal is stop crime.
Mm.
And so I think the lesson from superheroes is, the more powerful your character is, the greater a concept or the bigger a thing they need to struggle against. Because Batman doesn't struggle against any individual criminal. He struggles against crime. And that's what will always keep him fighting and making choices and driving conflict and story.
I'd never thought about it that way. That's a really good point, is that essentially these larger-than-life characters are struggling against problems that can't be solved, essentially. They're sort of a stopgap measure for a systematic issue that is so large that there isn't really a ultimate solution to it.
Right. And that they have to, because if Superman's only goal was to stop muggings, it would be really easy for that to be accomplished. But because his goal is right injustice and protect the planet, it can still provide compelling story. And that it fails the most. Superhero stories about these giant figures fail the most when they forget what that hero should be struggling against. And conversely, what made Marvel Comics so revolutionary when it started coming out with the Fantastic Four and the Amazing Spider-Man was showing how a superhero can struggle against amazing, earth-shattering things as a superhero, but still struggle with really normal, mundane things as a person.
Yeah, actually, I was going to mention that next in terms of origin stories, but specifically with Spider-Man, how he's the kind of character you like when he punches Doc Ock in the face. He's the kind of character you love when he fails to get a date with Mary Jane. So I guess that's it. It's you really, really kind of gain affection for this character when you are able to see yourself in the struggle. I think that humanizing element is actually what this rule is all about. I kind of had a thought earlier where we were talking about kind of that story. Robin, you mentioned, you know, here's good guy, here's bad guy, punch in face, end of story.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of early mythology and legends follow that archetype. You've got Beowulf, early Arthurian legends. It's all about strength of arms, martial superiority, and there isn't really a theme beyond man beat monster, man beat other man.
See, I don't know if I agree with that, because I've been reading a lot of Greek mythology lately, and a lot of the stories that I've seen actually have been boiled down by the point they reached me, and in the original one, it almost seems like the entire point of all of these hero stories is to essentially say, it doesn't matter how great you are if you are a complete jerk. Because almost like Hercules, terrible person. Achilles, terrible person. And in the end, they all meet often a very grisly, gruesome end. And I almost can't help but feel when I'm reading them, maybe it's because I'm a modern viewer and I'm looking at these characters and being like, you're horrible. But I almost wonder if the whole point is just, yeah, that guy got what was coming to him eventually.
Well,
it doesn't
that
matter who you are. If your behavior is bad, no matter how great you are, you will fall.
You don't admire Hercules or Achilles, but they never try. They always just succeed.
Yeah, so. And the way that they treat other people is with such a casual dismissal of their value all the time that you don't feel bad at all when they go down. Whereas, like, Odysseus is a much different character in Greek myth. And even though he goes on this long he's gone for 20 years, basically, from his wife and kid, he does actually make it back. And he does overcome those particular issues. And he does have this huge arc. And he's the only one that's actually kind of a decent person from the get-go.
Well, remember that when you're looking at those, you're also looking at them, looking at things that exist within a structure that tries to serve a slightly different purpose than our modern tellings of them. The purpose of Greek stories, the purpose of Greek theater and tragedy was the cleansing of emotion.
True.
And
true.
In order to do this, they, by not actual law, but by, you know, the dramatic rule, the main character had to go through the peripeteia, the reversal of fortunes, and be stricken low based on his heroic flaw. And so I think that Greek tragedy, because it wants to cleanse us of these emotions stops at that point. Achilles dies, although that's a pretty good, you know, stopping point. Oedipus kills himself. In modern stories that we tell, we want there to be that reversal of fortune, the lowest point, but then we also want the redemptive element that almost would have seemed superfluous or undermining, I think, to the Greeks. We want our hero to come out of the darkness and back into the light and learn his lesson and be a different and changed person.
And you know where I think that ultimately comes from? I think that it comes from being 8 years old. And I say this because I've been watching these kids, you know, during recess at my job now. And it's just really fascinating to watch these kids play, you know, superheroes or Star Wars or whatever it happens to be, because there's always half of the group that really wants to be bad guys and half of the group that wants to be good guys. And the thing that has always impressed me and kind of surprised me is that there is that redemptive element in there. They want to be the bad guy, but at the end of the day, they don't want to be dead. They don't want to be fully overcome. So there's always with the hope of redemption or rebirth. It's always present because otherwise somebody wouldn't get a chance to play.
Yeah.
So it's like there's this narrative where the kids know that the good guys have to win, but there's also this narrative that there's always a chance for the other side to be reborn, to come back, or to be redeemed. And I feel like that desire actually continues to run through our stories, even into adulthood, whether we know it or not.
So part of that is a failure of character. If we're going back to the original question, that if you start with a villain, there's already immediately an assumption that that person has had a moral failing in the past, and that is why they are the bad guy now. Is that what you kind of you're...
It makes sense. Especially if there's some sort of thematic moral discussion that the writer's trying to have.
Or it's being contrasted against the hero.
Mm-hmm.
With the clone character. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
See, it's kind of funny when you... Sorry, I have a random thought, but when you were saying 80s at the beginning of the podcast, my immediate thought was Die Hard. And the different Die Hard films, and how the first one is just so, like, grueling and but at the same time relatively small, and you're rooting for him the whole way through the film. But then in other Die Hards, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the trying gets less and less and less.
That's interesting. I read an article recently about kind of how Die Hard was paced, and there's a very obvious turning point in the film.
1 hour in.
Yes, right when he says "Yippee-ki-yay."
Yippee-ki-yay.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting because that's actually kind of the climax of the film, in terms of that's the moment when he stops running. That's the moment when he starts fighting and being more proactive. And I feel like the following films, I haven't seen the second one in a very long time. I don't really think that it holds for the third, and I'm absolutely certain it doesn't for 4 and 5. But it's interesting that that's it. It's we spend the first hour getting to love John McClane because he's failing. Then we see him succeed.
But he keeps trying, and I think ultimately that's the whole reason that this rule exists, you know, and is listed as number one. On this list of 22 rules is because I when I watched Die Hard, I thought about, like, what would I do in that situation if I, you know, was trying to be active, was trying to be involved, was trying to at least do something other than be a victim. And you could relate to the decisions he made and the difficulties he was going through. And you could go, yeah, you know, I could put myself in that person's place. And so it's like you build a little John McClane in your own heart. And then you kind of say, I really like that guy. I really like the John McClane part of me. So when the John McClane in the film succeeds, you're just so excited and just engaged in this because you could see yourself there. And now you can also imagine yourself succeeding against these horrible odds, but managing to keep going, and you understand how hard it is to keep trying when you keep failing.
So well, I could have done that. I could have been that. I could have won.
Yeah.
There's a comedian that said that the difference between what men and women want out of a movie is women want to go to a movie and see something emotional that they feel that they can relate to. Guys want to come out of a movie saying, yeah, I know Kung Fu. I could do that.
But ultimately, if the whole thing is you kind of put yourself in the film, that's the identical thing.
It is.
It's exactly the same. It's just kind of a way to say that men are either more simple or more machismo.
I'm not saying I agree with it necessarily. I just, your comment reminded me of it, and I thought it was a funny enough connection. I think that
yeah. It's in my nature to shoot down anything that I in will take as a stereotype, Matt. I just, you can set them up, and I'm going to poke holes in them every time.
For me, I think it's very pithy and very, very oversimplified. That's
like
it's fine.
Most comedians.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's true.
I think the difference also is that Die Hard 1 makes it very personal,
yeah.
Whereas as it gets bigger, they stop. It stops being about John McClane, and he becomes the standard Bruce Willis, or created the standard Bruce Willis action guy. Whereas in the first one, since he was still coming off of mostly comedies, mm-hmm. He had to go through that journey. He had to go from being the wisecracking guy to the wisecracking action hero. And that established such a persona for him that they couldn't really do that journey, not just in other Die Hard movies, but in basically anything else he ever did.
Note to yeah. self, only hire comedians for my action flicks.
Well, no, but that's it. If you look at it, and this ties into one of the other things I wanted to bring up, actually, was if you look at before Die Hard, he was in comedies. He was in
Moonlighting.
And that was kind of what people thought of when they thought of Bruce Willis, just like before 1989 Batman, Michael Keaton had been in nothing but comedians. And so when he was cast, they said, wait, him?
Well, and he kind of returned to that afterward. I believe, like, right after Batman, he did, like, Multiplicity and a few other comedies.
Well, I think that his Batman had quite a bit of humor to it, if I remember. I mean, it's been a while since I watched the film, but I remember there being some pretty humorous moments in there, even though it's still, I think, essentially a comedy, that Batman.
Yeah,
there's weirdness in there for it not to be essentially a comedy still.
Well, it's very, oh God, the producer's name, Tim Burton. It's very Tim Burton.
Yeah.
In that it's Tim Burton looks at the world and sees the world as, I think, a gothic kind of gallows humor kind of place. And that sensibility comes across in most of his movies. So when he touched Batman, I think it really would end up that way. And looking at Bruce Willis, Michael Keaton went back to comedies. Bruce Willis, if you think about it, only really ever now does action comedies. What I'm trying to think of a straight comedy Bruce Willis has been in, and maybe it's just that they all were terrible and I can't remember them because I purged them from my memory, but
I don't think so. I mean, recently he's done Red, which is definitely
but that's
more,
an action comedy.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point. And before that, he did the films in the Whole Nine Yards series, again, an action comedy. He forever changed how the zeitgeist thought of him. So I think this is kind of a go on.
I was gonna say, looking back to Moonlighting. I think one of the interesting permutations of trying is the will they or won't they storyline, which is common in romantic comedies and specifically romantic comedy TV shows.
And sorry, I'm just
favorite.
She's opening that can of worms.
Yeah. Oh, love them romantic comedies. Fill me with rage. I mean happiness.
But if you think about it, if you're not having to walk barefoot over broken glass, if you're, say, trying to win your high school sweetheart, that is your version of trying. The fact that most of the time it's terrible, it's still how you show someone trying in an instant where there is no physical danger. There is no labor to be done. There are no lions to fight.
Well, there should be some danger. And I actually think this is why a lot of romantic comedies are so terrible. Is that there isn't...
Breathe, Robin.
Yeah,
breathe.
There should be danger. And it should be danger to the heart, which is a more difficult wound to close in the first place. And often...
I don't know, have you tried closing bullet wounds?
Yeah, you can heal those, but people will carry the wounds of the heart for their entire lives and kill opportunities on their way because of what they carry. I would argue that wounds of the heart are harder to heal in a lot of ways. And I feel like a lot of romantic comedies don't really put the heart at risk, other than sort of on a upper level, shallow level, or they have to kind of induce harm by going through these really ridiculous, convoluted, makes no sense that you would ever love that person after they did that to you plot lines.
Kind of carrying that on there. So you were saying they kind of have this will they, won't they sort of dynamic, and you need to kind of pass back and forth between that through the course of the film.
I just said that they do.
Well, in this case, the won't they part of the will they, won't they is the failure that we, you know, keep returning to, and that's where we should love our characters. I think the issue here is when they do the will they, that's easy. People have chemistry. They like each other. We all get that. When they do the won't they, the section where we really have to start liking these characters for trying and failing, the only solution they can ever, well, not solution, the only way they can ever do a won't they in these films is through lying or humiliation. And
yeah,
that doesn't endear the character at all. I'm thinking back to, like, in Hitch, which is one of the, in my opinion, better examples of the genre, the entire miscommunication between the two main characters is predicated partly on a misunderstanding and partly on a malicious lie by a third party. And then another one, which I kind of enjoy as a guilty pleasure, is 10 Things I Hate About You.
That one's one of the better ones.
It is. But the entire way he wins her over at the end is by humiliating himself in front of everybody.
Yeah, but it's different when it's self-harm than it when it's, I hurt the other person, and then they somehow love me because I have hurt them.
I guess I made a misstep there because he succeeds.
He succeeds.
When he humiliates himself. So that isn't a won't they, that's a will they.
Ah, I see what you're saying. It's kind of interesting that you bring up this subject too, though, because I just was watching Some Like It Hot, which is a pretty fun old-timey film.
Going with the deep cuts?
Maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah, you might
want
to explain that one.
A deep cut is a record in an album that was not the single that the band released. A deep cut is kind of colloquially used to refer to going deep into a catalog. And while Some Like It Hot was super big at its time and is certainly influential on cinema, it is now kind of a more obscure...
It is a little bit, but it's actually, the reason I looked at it was because of Tumblr, so it's not that lost. It's on Netflix right now, so I figured, let's see what all the hubbub is about. And what's really interesting is the plot of Some Like It Hot, since it is, as you say, a deep cut, is that two men witness a mob murder and have to get out of town and disappear for a while so that they're not killed for being witnesses. So they pretend to be women because there's a female-only band going down to Florida. So they figure, yeah, we'll get out of Chicago, we'll pretend to be women, no one will think to find us. And in the course of the film, the cad that is at the beginning of the film established as a womanizer, use 'em and leave 'em, borrow money from women and whatever other favors he wants and then just sort of dump him by the wayside guy, falls in love with a woman called Sugar, who's on the band, who's sort of a always falls in love with the guy that will use her. So he's pretending to be a woman and kind of getting to know her, and at the same time wants to woo her. So it was fascinating because Corey came home when I was halfway through the film and I said, I have to see what the end of this film is, because on the one hand, I really like these characters. And on the other hand, I cannot stand them and I would punch them in the face. And it was just like this really weird dichotomy, because what I was constantly cheering for was not the romance. I was not hoping that there would be some kind of romance, because he starts, he finds out that what she's hoping to find in Florida is this millionaire who will solve her problems and won't leave her and will treat her right. And she's looking for a sensitive guy with glasses, and that you can tell that a guy's good if he's wearing glasses because he's kind and gentle somehow. So he poses in his spare time as a millionaire with glasses and just uses and everyone around him to try and woo her with no intention of sticking around afterwards. So what I was actually cheering for was that somehow through this experience of getting to know her on a more intimate, as in person-to-person level, while he's being a woman, that he would become a better person and not do to her what he was clearly planning to do. So I wasn't cheering for the romance. I was cheering for him to grow as a human being. And there wasn't a lot of trying on his part to be a better human being. So it's sort of, that was kind of the exception there, was there was no trying effort happening for the thing that the film, I think, was ultimately trying to be about. That all the trying was happening for the thing he shouldn't do. And those were the things I wanted to hit him for.
Well, I think what also the Pixar rules exist in a time when we've had, you know, variously depending on the medium, 80 or 60 years of this kind of advanced storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I think that looking back at those movies, they're trying to accomplish different things. It's movies for a long time were just about providing and entertaining a timeout. And I think it was really, although what's funny is that the guy that directed Some Like It Hot also directed Double Indemnity, which is kind of one of the codifiers of film noir. Mm-hmm. But that genre was not designed to really make us think too deeply. It was to be there, to be funny, have a romance, some songs, some dances, everyone goes home happy.
At the same time, it really felt like it was trying to explore ideas. And there was a lot of elements in it where I was kind of like it was making commentary on what it was like to be a woman and what it was like to be a man and the frustrations of that and the gender expectations of that. So it felt like it was pretty self-aware about what it was doing. So I don't know if I can completely say, well, it doesn't qualify because it was a different time of storytelling.
But I think at the same time, it was also hamstrung by the requirements of the time, which is more what I was trying to say, but better. And, you know, I'd say we should go wipe out my earlier dumber comment in post, but then you'd just be responding to nothing. I think that it if it was made now, it could be about that you could make a movie now that subverts the rom-com will they, won't they, by having him realize at the end what a manipulative jerk he's been away.
He kind of does, but he still gets the girl. So there's right, this sort of like the very last bits of the film are kind of him basically saying, no, now that you know who I actually am, you don't want me because I'm everything that you shouldn't want. And then she basically like says, no, I want you anyways.
Right.
So,
and I think in 2014, the movie could end there and it would be cool. In 1959, there was no way a studio would let the movie end there.
That is where it ended, pretty much.
Well, but no, I mean, a modern movie, it could get away with her going, oh, okay, and walking away.
I see what you're saying.
In 1959, it had to end with him getting her anyway. Because they weren't going to have all these people in a movie and have there not be the guy gets the girl.
I guess I kind of feel like we all are just as hamstrung today. One, I don't think that movie would be made today because there's not enough explosions. And I guess, too, is I feel like we are just as bound by a lot of the tropes and requirements, unspoken requirements for film, as we were at that time. I don't think we've really changed or advanced very much at all. Maybe even gotten worse in some respects.
I think we're definitely stuck in popular culture, but I think in 2014, you could make Some Like It Hot as an indie film, put whatever ending you wanted on it, cut out the explosions, and sell it at Sundance, and that there is a greater, or Netflix would buy it directly. I think that there's a greater room around the edges to make those movies that escape from the tropes than there was at the time when the studios had a stranglehold on everything because it was so prohibitively expensive.
That I'll agree with you.
I kind of had a thought back on what you said there was, at the end there, he kind of has that moment where he's saying, now that you know who I am, you couldn't possibly love me, why would you bother? And actually, the way you said it kind of reminded me of Marty McFly from the original Back to the Future, with the whole, what if she says, get out of here, kid, you got no future. And it strikes me that with all of this trying and by proxy all of this failing, is maybe there's an underlying self-esteem issue that's kind of something we need to tie into our main character in order to make them relatable to our audience. What do you guys think about that?
I don't know if that's the intent. I think that it might speak more to people because of that. I guess I personally think that the trying period, the trial period, is more just an echo of how we learn as human beings. So when we see it, we go, that is true. That is real. Because I know that every time I've had to, you know, I want to learn guitar, or I want to learn how to do public speaking, or whatever. There's a trial period where I have to develop the skills to do that, and that involves a lot of frustration and failure. So I don't know if it's a self-esteem issue so much as it's just a, this is how it is to be human.
Well, and I think that at its heart, at the core of it, this rule is a way of stating the similarly related truth that it is conflict that drives story, and is a very elegant way of saying if your character succeeds too often, we will be bored, and that we need to see that conflict as he or she attempts to gain what he or she desires, or learns what he or she should actually be desiring the whole time, that will propel the plot. And I think that that's what this is getting to, that
if you give your
character too hard a time, people will root for them. If you give your character too easy a time, people will fall asleep.
Well, and it can work backward too, with the idea like if you find that your character is not likable because they haven't been trying, it might be because there's an underlying problem with your conflict as a whole.
Yeah.
See, and I actually disagree with the idea that conflict is what drives stories. I know that that's kind of the Western convention, but I actually think that the more accurate term is that growth drives stories.
Yes, I would agree with that. I was about to amend my comment with sensible conflict, or conflict that fits, that makes narrative sense,
mm-hmm.
drives stories. Because I think what drives you crazy about romantic comedies in part, and I know it's what drives me crazy about romantic comedies in part, is the artificiality of the conflict.
Yeah. And also, though, to expand on the artificiality, it's not true. And it sells you this idea that true love often will come from lies and abuse. And neither of those are recipes for healthy, loving relationships. But they
right.
tell you that that is what it is. And I guess I hate being lied to. I often don't mind if you're going to do something horrible, stupid, and objectionable if you don't try and sell it to me as anything other than what it is.
Tell me if you're going to be a jerk and I'll be okay with it.
Yeah. I mean, I won't hang around to interact with you if you're a jerk, but if you're actually a jerk and you say, I'm a jerk, and then you act like a jerk, I'll respect you for that. At least you know what you're doing. The same way that, like, when superheroes... Like, I would not mind if DC did an entire line of Black Label softcore crap comics. Cheesecake, yeah. If they just flat out were like, this is a cheesecake title. And I would be like, well, at least you know what you're selling. It's not for me, but more power to you. Instead, they make cheesecake titles or characters where they're like, oh, their background is a stripper and they're empowered. No. Stop lying to me.
Yeah. If you're going to make porn, have the guts to make porn.
Yes.
Don't sell me Catwoman. Catwoman-themed pornography and look me in the eye and say it's Catwoman.
And then blame me for women not being interested in XYZ. No. It's your fault. Sorry, this rant topic for some reason.
Well, we can talk about it now or we can save it for another episode.
We just keep bringing me back to things that are like, I'm going to get upset about this. I got to dial it down. I got to back away. Back away.
On next week's episode of Robin Yells at the Internet.
Pure rage. I'm known as the Hulk in my Webcomic Alliance group. So
we wouldn't like you when you're angry.
And I'm angry all the time.
Now is when we should cue up the sad Hulk music.
That would be appropriate, yes. I'll have to go find some sad Hulk music just for that, such an occasion.
Oh, no, the classic Hulk TV show piano.
Yeah, where he's walking along the highway trying to get a lift and no one will pick him up.
Dun, 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 dun.
Story of my life.
Because that's what people really want to hear when they tune into a podcast. My terrible humming of the sad Hulk music.
Well, they gotta get the worst first, Matt. They have to know how bad it can get.
I'm sure there's a niche audience for it.
There's a niche audience.
Yeah,
Matt, what's important is that you're trying, and we'll like it.
An A for effort and H for Hulk execution.
All right, I've been sitting on this one in my back pocket.
Back pocket.
I would like to talk about the Venture Brothers, who, by admission of its creators, the theme of which is failure. For those of you at home who don't know, the Venture Brothers is a modern cartoon that is a parody.
Stop listening if you don't know the Venture Brothers.
Yeah, go watch it right now. Season 1 is on Netflix. There are five seasons, and they're very, very good, and they get better as they go.
It may take an adjustment period. At first, for me, it was kind of like, what am I watching? But once you ease into the world, then it becomes a pretty darn good show.
Basically, the idea is it's what would have happened if Johnny Quest had grown up and realized that his childhood was actually horrible and was severely traumatized as a result.
It was a neurotic, egotistical wreck.
But couldn't break the cycle of abuse and was raising his two boys the same way.
And it's a comedy. So...
Well, yeah, knock it out of the park. That's a great premise for a comedy.
Do we really know how to summarize stuff or what?
It's abuse, but it's funny.
It's funny. No, really. Actually, sometimes it is pretty harsh, but it's an interesting show because of the failure element. Because you are actually constantly rooting for a lot of these characters to do something, and they do grow, which is actually surprising for a comedy show about failure. To be able to say these characters grow, but there is actual character growth and change, or character change might be a more accurate term.
I think there's growth. The main character, Rusty Venture, his whole thing is he's slowly becoming more and more self-aware. He's more and more understanding exactly how traumatized he has been.
I think just how far he's fallen. And I think that Rusty's whole thing is kind of becoming okay with the idea that maybe he's never going to be his dad. Maybe he's never going to be this amazing globe-trotting super scientist that gets all the ladies and knows all the science and saves the day. And like, instead, he's just going to be kind of this sad, sad little, not nearly as smart as his dad guy. And maybe that's all right. Like, that, it seems like they're kind of reaching sort of an acceptance point in the later series.
And a realization that he'll never be as smart as his dad, but he can be better to his children.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really think that's interesting.
Yeah, and it is great because they fail so much that you are sitting there going, come on, guys, just once, make it. Get that brass ring. Do something mostly competent. And that's why the character of Brock Sampson, the Swedish murder machine, works so well, because he is the only one on the show consistently that gets to succeed at even the most simple of tasks.
Well, he succeeds, but at the same time, on a personal level, he often seems to fall short.
Right. His failures are different, so they provide contrast. The Ventures fail at adventuring, saving people, science, morality, basic human interactions. Brock Sampson fails at other things, but makes up for it by killing a lot of people, which would sound really bad.
No, it's fine, Matt. Keep going.
You get to the end of the show where you've watched all of the Ventures make it worse, and then Brock comes in and gloriously kills people, and it's like, good, I needed some level of success to balance this out.
Now, I do think that that's kind of the shadow side of this idea of that you need characters to try, is that we also like competence. And I have seen shows where the character is just so incompetent at everything that it's instead of it crosses the line between relatable to you're pathetic.
Yeah.
And that can happen, that if they never have any point at which, because again, I think what drives interest is growth. And if you never see any type of change, if the character always stays exactly where they are, then I think that it actually, the trying element works against it.
Well, absolutely. And then, the show obviously needs a yardstick, somebody to contrast and to pace against. And actually, I think that's interesting. Your description of how Brock Sampson works on the show is very, very accurate for seasons 1 and 2. But eventually, as the others become more and more self-aware, and as a result, more self-confident and a little more competent themselves, we realize that Brock's being left behind in the dust. He's the one who's not growing. He's the one who's achieved a baseline competence, but can't overcome and become better than he already is.
And actually, it makes me think your description of a lot of this, it reminds me of The Simpsons, because people think of Homer in particular as just a big dumb idiot, but that's more Homer later in the series. Homer in the earlier versions of The Simpsons, which are I think widely considered the better part of what The Simpsons was, he's a big dumb guy that loves eating and all the rest of it, but he'll also have these little moments where he'll be an amazingly good father, or he'll do something and he'll realize he's made a mistake and he'll do something to make up for it. There is still a win condition here that redeems the character. So I think that in that case, the trying is almost sort of you're going through the struggle with them to make the realization, or to make the, to make up for the wrong. Because you can see the wrong from the get-go. You can see the problem. And so you're constantly cheering them on to make up for what they've done.
Well, and I think The Simpsons suffers from the fact, mostly, that it's been on for a quarter of a century.
Wow, that puts in perspective.
And I think that can be another topic for a whole nother podcast, is the problem with long running shows, of how you tend to fall into, and the technical term, I'm not making this up, flanderization, where you become caricatures and those early quirks become the defining parts of your character. And you can look at almost any long-running show and see them struggling with this. The Big Bang Theory, whatever you think about The Big Bang Theory.
South Park immediately comes to mind.
South Park. I think Supernatural struggled with it. I was
just thinking about Supernatural struggling with this particular issue.
But to get back to the trying, I was actually about to bring up Supernatural. because Supernatural is one of those shows, I think, where it has both done it very well and done it very poorly and made fun of itself doing it very poorly, which makes it awesome, but also really weird.
Yeah, I was just chuckling earlier because there seems to be, even in the good episodes, there's that episode right before the end of every season where they both kind of lay it out and that they go and they air their dirty laundry, and it's always the same list plus the one other thing you failed at this season.
Right.
They just go on and on about it. They do that every year.
And they're the living embodiment of you've got heart, you've got soul, but what you don't have is the talent, to borrow from South Park. They're really good at what they do on an individual level, but the whole tension of the show is built around they will not find out what's going on until it's almost too late to stop it. They will not solve their problems until the very last minute. And overarchingly, and this is what I think is a lot of drag as you go on, even though I think that after season 6 and season 7 mostly it has picked up,
it just
they fail too much. It has to always be them angsting on the road. No one can ever be happy. Nothing long term can ever be built, because then the core image would be changed and therefore to a lot of people ruined. And it just creates this sense of weariness that I think even the boys in and out of universe feel.
Yeah. And I actually, if I was the writer, I think that I would probably tackle that as a central issue for a seasonal arc and try and bring the fun back in. I mean, the show's still got a lot of humor in it, but it has gotten much, much darker, much grimmer, much heavier. And I think that that weight is actually sort of pulling it a little bit down. So I think that if I was to tackle that, I guess I would just flat out make that the problem and have them address that, because I think it is an issue that you can, even in the darkest times, you can find light. So,
well, and they do, and that's what makes it really they do it a lot, and that humor, the gallows humor that they have, is one of the things that continues to make it one of my favorite shows. But I think the one of the best moments they've had is, I can't remember the exact line, but they're doing something and Dean basically just says, "Man, I'm over 30 now." And the fact that they give him this awareness and give both of them this awareness that their lives are terribly self-destructive makes it both real and at the same time kind of sad.
Mm-hmm.
Sad in that funny way, though. I mean, the whole thing played as a laugh.
I just want those boys to be happy.
That line reminded me of when I first found Welcome to Night Vale. And I was fascinated how early in Welcome to Night Vale, it basically takes everyone, when it comes to Cecil, because he's pining over this perfect person that he's met on the radio, and it renders everyone that listens to it into the old lady matchmaker down the street just going, "I just want that boy to be happy. Go for it, sonny." You almost can't help but start rooting Cecil on. Because of this, you see kind of the desire and these sort of awkward attempts. So even there, it's sort of the trying element does kind of come in there a bit. But more, I think it's just you like the character so much that you want them to succeed. And maybe that's the other part of trying, is it's this opportunity for success. And that creates kind of that question mark that keeps you looking and keeps you going and keeps your interest.
As a side note, if you are listening to this podcast and have not listened to Welcome to Night Vale, press pause and we'll see you in about 15 hours.
Actually, I think that's a great point. Earlier, what you were talking about with the thing that Cecil is trying to start this relationship, he kind of has a one-sided will they, won't they, and it's really kind of fascinating. But ultimately, I think that might be a part of the issue that I've been having with the show lately since the end of its year one, and that's Cecil hasn't had a goal, and therefore he's not trying anything.
He has seemed to kind of lost a lot of his opinions.
Have you heard the most recent one?
Yes,
numbers?
Yes. The March 1st episode, guest starring Molly Quinn, I thought was an excellent return to form.
I thought that was amazing. Mm-hmm.
It was a very, very good episode. But it gave Cecil a goal. We got a peek behind the curtain for a moment, and I really appreciated that.
So I guess that's, you know, I keep trying to bring it back, and it's this goal element. It gives the audience something to root for. So trying without a goal, I mean, that's antithetical. It doesn't make any sense. So the fact that a character is trying something also implies that the character has a goal, has a motive.
So should that be part of the rule? Like, just first off, set a goal for your character. I mean, it sounds silly and simple, but...
Well, not really, because I've seen so many characters, and I used to struggle with this personally, that had no motive. And motive, I think, is so key to writing a strong story and to writing a strong character, because we all have things that we want out of life. We might not even necessarily know exactly what it is, but we probably have an idea or a goal that we're trying to pursue on some level. And when we write characters, it's so easy to kind of leave that part out. And without a strong goal, you cannot drive a narrative particularly easily. It can be done. I'm never going to say that you can't, you know, universally cannot do something with writing, because there's always going to be an exception out there. But in general, especially if you're not specifically trying to do it, writing a story without characters that have motive is a very challenging task.
Absolutely. The immediate example that comes to my mind, and maybe I'm wrong, is Thank You for Smoking. The main character of Nick Naylor, I feel, doesn't have a specific objective at any point other than to kind of be the smartest man in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's still an objective, though. And I think it's interesting that I think that there definitely needs to be, in order for this to be a more complete rule, as we're going to sit here and point out the flaws in Pixar.
They ain't perfect either. Cars too.
Yeah, recently.
and planes. I think that, yes, that bundled in with this are your character needs to have a goal, because purposeless trying is as bad as a goal without trying. And that it needs to be something that drives the story. I think in Welcome to Smoking, he starts out not having a goal, but he evolves into having a goal. And that even if the goal is banal, and I pronounce that word really weirdly for some reason, but even if the goal is stupid or small or petty, if that's the point, then you can do it well. But it needs to be, the goal needs to be something related to the point or contrasting the point, if what you're doing is telling a story about a person who reorganizes their life's direction.
Well, I think you're right about that, yeah.
Sometimes having kind of petty goals, but having someone really struggle to get there and then finally achieve it can be a very satisfying thing to watch. I don't know why, but...
I actually don't think that Nick's ultimate goal... Like, you've convinced me that I think he starts out wanting to be the smartest person in the room, but he's not really trying, because he usually is at the start of the film. At the end of the film, I think his goal shifts into something completely unpetty, which is he's trying to teach his son that there is something more important than being the smartest person in the room.
Right, and that's the thing, is that he evolves into having a worthwhile goal. And that can be, I mean, that's a very common thing. I think, look at the movie Liar Liar. In the beginning, his goal is only to kind of do whatever is convenient to himself and get out of anything that's inconvenient. then his goal becomes get his ability to lie back so he can be a good lawyer, which as an attorney, trust me, I love that message.
Return to the status quo was his goal, though.
It evolves into his goal of being a good person and father. And so I think the pursuit of a worthy goal is a great story to tell, but you have to go into it purposefully. You can't just have, oh, I decided on a goal halfway through, whatever.
It's interesting that you mentioned Liar Liar, because I feel like that one has one of the more interesting missteps on this rule, which is the Cary Elwes character who's kind of stepped in for Fletch, the Jim Carrey character, and is gonna marry his ex-wife, is gonna raise his son, is exactly the kind of person who's trying, not always succeeding, is well-meaning, and as a result, totally likable. And in the end, he just gets the shaft.
Yeah. In that romantic comedy way where since he is not the protagonist, he must lose. And which I guess is true of anything. Our protagonists win, our antagonists lose generally. But yeah, there is a particular strain in romantic comedies where if the other guy is a complete douchebag, you feel okay with it. But if he's not a complete douchebag, you get done with the movie and you're like, oh, that was funny. Wait, Cary Elwes wasn't a bad guy and he got royally shafted.
Unless you're me and you come out of the film wanting to take a baseball bat and just hurt everyone in the room. But maybe we just watch romantic comedies differently.
One, why are you watching romantic comedies with a baseball bat in hand? And is Corey in a safe place right now? And
I'm
two,
deep in my bunker, far, far away.
Is there, now I'm curious, this is derailing it, but is there a romantic comedy you like, or are they universally infuriating?
There are romantic comedies I like. I liked Romancing the Stone. I thought that one was good.
That is a good
the
one.
The sequel was crap.
Yeah, but the original was good. I thought, like I said, 10 Things I Hate About You is, I think, pretty well done. And it's one of the better romantic comedies. Hitch, I like half of that film. And the other half makes me angry.
The
but
Kevin
at least
James
that's half
half,
a film.
I assume.
Hey, it's a step up from what was the Matthew Well, okay, let me just rephrase. It's a step up from any romantic comedy with Matthew McConaughey.
Which one is the Matthew McConaughey career? Yeah.
So there are some, and there might be more out there, but I just the ones that I often will have people be like, oh, this is so funny, it's so great, and I'll watch it, and I'll just be so furious at the end. Romantic comedies have a better track record with me than just straight romance films. Romance films, I have never watched one where I have come out of it feeling happy.
Okay, opposite question. Worst romantic comedy or romance film you've seen?
Ever After. That's,
ooh, that's a good one.
That's the one that birthed this hatred. That is the source, the primeval soup of rage that fuels every bit of bias against romantic anything.
Well, I'm going to stir the pot here a little bit, but isn't that one about trying and failing?
Yeah, I guess you could say that it is. I mean, there's trying going on.
I just realized that may have sounded like I was defending Ever After. I was not.
That's probably for the best that you clarify that.
I think that the one that really for me, like, what are you doing? Why are you here? And why was this put before me was How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
Never saw it.
I saw it with my high school girlfriend. Which tells you exactly how much of a ladies' man I am. But it was, it was at that time in Matthew McConaughey's career where he was a leading man. And as opposed to the last, really 4 years where he's decided he's a character actor and he's actually pretty good at it. And it's just bad. They are both terrible people because they're both in this relationship as a bet to see how easy it is to drive the other off, hence the titular How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. She might just be there for that. It's been a while. No, they're both. I just looked it back up. Matthew McConaughey is there on a bet that he can make any woman fall in love with him. And Kate Hudson is there as for her job, showing how she can drive away any boyfriend in 10 days.
And what so kind of job would you ever have where that would be a requirement? Do you put that on a resume?
I'm guessing magazine.
I can alienate men within
something.
10 days. Yeah, we're hiring you. You'll be a great salesperson.
Yeah, I'm guessing Cosmo Writer.
That would be it in one.
I've never seen that one. That's the Kate Hudson one, right?
Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey was in kind of a deep hole in his career in that period. I believe Sahara came out in the same general period.
That's kind of the same era. And he was in a couple of these. He was in one with Sarah Jessica Parker. He was in another one with Kate Hudson. But yeah, it's the whole point that what kills it for me is, yeah, they're trying their butts off, but they're trying for a terrible reason. They're both awful people, and there is no reason why I like either of them aside from that they're pretty, and the movie tells me that I should.
Well, on the plus side, they deserve each other.
So there is an exception to this rule.
Yeah.
If you are trying for something that is horrible, and by doing so, you highlight on what a horrible person you are, we will not like you more for trying than we will like you for succeeding.
And yet this thing made $180 million. God in heaven.
So what do we know?
Apparently, yeah. Look, shut it down. Shut the whole podcast down.
Yes, but who's talking about how to drop a guy in 10 days now?
Point.
Yeah. Us.
Yeah. Ugh. Thank you for reeling that back in. I was going to say that my favorite romantic comedy is probably So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Oh,
that's
yeah, that one would be on my list of good ones.
I'd have to watch it again, because again, the a lot of the won't they is predicated on lying. Admittedly, Mike Myers ends up lying because he feels he will be made into small bits of sushi if he doesn't, but
I think it's different when it's a self-aware lie. When the audience knows that the character might be lying, but the film is not lying to its audience. So I guess, again, it comes back to that hiccup that we were talking about with me earlier, is don't lie to me. If you are showing the characters and you're saying flat out, yes, they are lying, and we acknowledge that they're lying, and it probably isn't a good thing, but you can kind of get where they're coming from. That's one thing. But when the film says, these two people are lying, and that's true love, that I have a problem with, because I know that that is not true.
I think that's the difference between lying and tricking. An audience will never appreciate being lied to. Your film is not telling the truth. Audiences don't mind being fooled, just being lied to.
Well, if they're fooled, it's a magic trick.
Exactly.
And it's a grand reveal, and everybody likes the surprise of a grand reveal magic trick. Whereas if it's something where you can obviously see whereas if it's a con, where someone basically asks for your wallet and then tells you that they're going to be doing a magic trick and then runs, that's a less pleasant experience, and that's how I feel at the box office if I go to
It's the difference between a magic trick where he says, this is a trick, and a magic trick where at the end of the trick he tries to sell the trick as real.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I really made that building disappear.
Well, and I think for me, the romantic comedy that I've enjoyed the most recently, since I've developed an allergy to them as well, but I saw Silver Linings Playbook.
I've heard that one's not terrible.
It starts off by explaining this guy is bipolar and was just released from a psychiatric hospital, and the girl is messed up in the head too, and it's very honest that these are very broken people, even if especially Bradley Cooper's character takes a while to really realize it. He lives in this delusional world for the first three quarters of the movie, where he is going to get better, get himself right and medicated and in a good headspace and get back with his ex-wife. But the movie is very honest in how it approaches it, in that you know this is not going to happen. There is not a point during the movie when I ever thought that they were actually going to end up back together. And not just because Jennifer Lawrence does not play his ex-wife and she's on the poster, so he's going to get with the woman who's on the poster, but because the movie makes no bones about it. This is not that story. This is not that guy. It's about him learning not to lie to himself, learning to appreciate this other person, and to get himself in that headspace by being honest about it. And I really liked that because it set that tone very well.
Mm-hmm. Kind of in that same vein, a movie I've been wanting to see is Her.
I want to see that.
Yeah, Joaquin Phoenix falls in love with a computer voiced by Scarlett Johansson. Probably in the same reason. Just looking at the trailers, looking at the promotional material, I feel like they've set a tone, and it's consistent throughout, and they're not lying to me.
It's funny, I was thinking about how we've all talked about mostly movies, and I was trying to think about when have I seen this particular rule in books or other media, because stories are stories no matter where you go. And I realized that one of my favorite series, one of the reasons that I really like the main character, is because they are always kind of this constant state of trying, failing, thinking something up new, and it's the Dresden series by Jim Butcher.
Yeah.
Harry at the end is always kind of this complete wreck. And that, to the point where it almost kind of gets overdone, but I still have always enjoyed that because I felt like he earned his successes. He earns his triumphant moment because he's always kind of trying, and, you know, some things succeed and some things don't. It's never that he completely fails, because we've been emphasizing failure a lot. And I think it's also important to note that usually when we're learning something, we don't completely abject, total wipeout fail when we're learning something. We usually have some successes, but not in the ways that we anticipated or not as well as we would hope for.
Speak for yourself. I took algebra for 4 years in a row.
Well, I guess I was always good with math, so. But guitar, on the other hand.
I think that, definitely Dresden Files has embraced the philosophy that, if I can pull from Corey in my background, they talked about in one of the role-playing game supplement books that we read, where your characters want to go through Die Hard. They want to be bleeding and broken and walk over broken glass at the end, but come out winning. And the Dresden Files definitely embraces that, that ideology that Harry has to get the crap knocked out of him and barely come out ahead.
Yeah. Or even kind of win at what he was doing, but not really come out ahead.
Yeah, fair enough. Other books where that is the case. Well, and I think that the problem, books suffer from a unique problem in this because it can get repetitive. Like there's a series I read, the Mickey Haller Attorney series, that I've recently had to say I'm probably done reading, because it's a book series by Michael Connelly about an attorney named Mickey Haller. And the first book is The Lincoln Lawyer, which was then turned into a movie with Matthew McConaughey. So we're all tying it together. But he goes through this character growth in the first book. He tries to be a good attorney, but then he realizes he's kind of failing as a human and disconnected from his daughter and his ex-wife. And so he starts trying to get back with them and makes these good gains in his life. And then between the first book, The Lincoln Lawyer, and the second book, off screen, that all disappears. He backslides. he gets addicted to the pain pills because he gets shot over the course of the Lincoln Lawyer. His addiction causes him to fall out with his wife and his daughter, and he's back to defending anyone. And then over the course of the Brass Verdict, he goes through and he reconnects with his wife and daughter and focuses on being a better person. And I can't remember what it is, but between every book, he backslides to be at the same or an even worse position than he was before and has to go through the same character growth. And
see, backsliding is actually a really interesting issue in this kind of topic, because backsliding is something that happens with personal growth a lot, especially if you're dealing with things related to depression. I'm, for those that don't know, I have chronic depression, and I know a lot of people that have struggled with issues related to chronic depression, and it's backsliding is this really difficult process, but it's also pretty much inevitable. And I think the trick to actually getting it to work is that you can't, you never actually go to step zero again. It feels like that's what's happening. And so I can see why a writer might do that. Also, it kind of seems like a cheap and easy way to do the same character growth and never have to change it. But the reality of backsliding is that you are going to a different place because you now have a new perspective. If you have survived a really dark period once, the fact that you return to that place means that you know that you can come out of it. And that fundamentally changes the experience.
Well, and if it was just one backslide or even two backslides, it would be fine. If it was one off-screen backslide and one on-screen backslide, it would be fine. My problem, because, you know, I come from a family that deals with addiction, and I've seen the exact same thing. You very rarely get sober on the first try, and you feel like you go back to this place. But I think for a lot of people, like you said, it's building this reservoir of experience and how to deal with it. And if it was that, that would be fine. But I think over the course of a longer series, authors get tempted to put characters back in the place they were when the magic happened, when the lightning struck.
Just hit the reset button.
The status quo gets put back into place forcibly so that they can make the same growth. And that's the thing that drove me off, ultimately, the Mickey Howler series, is that, yeah, he's trying his butt off in every book, but it's always the same trials. And so I have no emotional investment anymore in it.
But I actually think that's exactly one of the things that's really good about the Jim Butcher series, is because he's so good about working with backsliding, because he hangs a lantern on it. And he has Harry kind of come to realizations throughout the series. And one of the big ones is his need to kind of keep people in the dark as a means to protect them. And flat out in the book, he's done things where he'll be acting on basically that pattern, and then he'll stop and start almost talking to himself, being like, oh, wait, no, I did the thing again that I'm not supposed to do, and now I have to kind of force myself to stop and inform people and try to not do what I want to do instinctively. So he actually takes the process of backsliding and incorporates it in a way that is true. And I think the reason that you're objecting to this other book series so strongly is because it is false. Because it's just a reset button to conveniently do the same thing over and over. But in reality, like you said, it's build an experience. And even if it might be essentially the same arc being explored, it's a little bit different every time.
Yeah, and that would make all of the difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. I think a big part of this is the author of the series you're talking about. I'm speaking from at least my perspective here, is he's probably dealing with an issue and is backsliding himself. And when that happens, you know, if he hasn't gotten beyond it, he doesn't see a perspective where he can let his character get beyond it.
Yeah, and it's possible. I also think that there's, and it's something that, God willing, someday we will all face, that we get really successful and we don't want to mess with that, because it does take a lot of artistic integrity and a lot of balls to say, this series is paying for my house and student loans, but I'm going to be true to it and say, you can't unring a bell. And accept that I have to change things ongoing and be true to that. It takes a lot of courage to do that. And not everyone wants to say, yes, I am willing to take a risk and change the dynamic of my magic money printing device.
A lot of the webcomic people that I've followed that have become successful, one of the things I hear them say a lot is always stay hungry, always stay nervous. And it's something that I feel really applies to this idea, is that you have to kind of keep yourself in a state of a little bit of anxiety that keeps you doing things, keeps you trying things and taking risky moves. And it's okay to take risky moves, because ultimately, I mean, in the case of this author, they might be thinking that they're protecting themselves by, you know, just reproducing the golden goose, but in reality, they've lost you.
Alternately, this could be actually the sneakiest science fiction series you've ever read, and this lawyer is experiencing a terrifying time loop.
Oh my God, that would be, if that was it, if in book six, I hear someone say it's aliens, I will buy the heck out of that book. I'll buy two.
You're welcome. To rekindle that interest in you, it's very gratifying.
Somehow, I don't think that when Mickey Howler book six comes out, I'm going to read the back cover and it's just going to say, who knew it was aliens?
Fan fiction. That's what fan fiction is for.
I have my own things that I want to write. I don't want to write better versions of other people's work. And let me say, for what it's worth, I enjoyed five books of this series. And I like Michael Connelly's other stuff. And I'm a kid with a spitball shooting out of a straw compared to somebody who was such an established mystery writer. They play cards with Castle, but I feel like it's easier to stay in one place for him. And Michael Connelly, if you're listening to this one, why are you listening to this? How did we find you? And can you share it with your friends? And two, sorry.
my literature offering, if you are willing to stoop to call it that, is John Dies at the End.
I think it counts as literature.
Yes.
I like how we made it exactly one most of an episode before we devolved to talking about John Dies at the End. Because it's one of Corey and my favorite books.
Yes, John Dies at the End by David Wong is kind of like a low-rent supernatural where instead of Sam and Dean, you get the manager of your local video rental store.
Kind of like Clerks meets Supernatural, actually.
That's an excellent description.
With a lot more surrealism mixed in.
What I like about it is it really exemplifies the role we were talking about with Pixar here, in that there is absolutely no reason beyond some sort of tenuous moral imperative that these people should continue trying to fight the insurmountable, surreal, Lovecraftian horror that seems to creep into their lives. Part of it is, you know, they've seen it, they can't unseen it, they can't unring that bell, like Matt said, and as a result, they're trapped and they have no choice. But you always get the sense, particularly at the end of the first book, that you do have a choice, and they've chosen to stay, even if that choice was very, very stupid.
Sometimes it's okay to make the stupid choice as long as it's the right choice, I think.
Well, it makes you sympathize with the character. It really kind of exemplifies that rule, I think.
Sometimes when all you have is a Bible taped to the end of a baseball bat, every problem starts to look like a demon.
Or baseball. Well, I think that we've talked quite a bit and quite a lot of variety about this rule. We have found a couple, I think, exceptions to the rule, but in general, I think that it's, if you want to build a character that people will relate to, that people will feel true, trying is a pretty necessary element to bonding with that particular character.
My takeaway from it is, yes, well, that is true. My big takeaway is have a worthy goal for your character. It's much easier to see them trying if the audience can, one, put themselves in the shoes of the protagonist, and two, also see the point of the trying. And the second takeaway I have it here is that Matthew McConaughey is apparently our poster boy for failure.
But ultimately trying.
Just won an Oscar, so I don't think he's hurting too badly.
Oh no, but the number of times he came up in this, I guess that's the point. He was the protagonist of this decade-long story, and at the start he was kind of in that Marty McFly position, and now he's, you know, Oscar winner Matthew McConaughey.
I think my takeaway is just restating the importance of trying and strife and conflict that's real and germane and organic. If you're creating any piece of media and you have to keep inventing new struggles just to fill pages because otherwise it'll be a pamphlet, then there is a fundamental problem that you need to address with your character's goals. Mm-hmm. Because any goal in the world has enough conflict that you can at least get it up to a novella. I feel like me getting up in the morning to go to work has enough conflict to drive at least a short story. So if you're really having to throw in artificial things, you need to rethink what your character wants to do. Unless the artificial conflict is ninja, because fighting ninja is always a good move for characters.
Caveat, ninja exception.
Ninja exception.
The ninja exception, which I think is going to be a recurring theme that we're going
to
find.
That may
over
be
most
an exception to
rules.
Every Pixar rule.
The ninja exception. All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us today on our very first episode. We look forward to talking with you about so many more things. Matt, where can we find more of your work if people are curious about you?
My work is currently a series of articles on the best named website on the internet, www.dishonoronyourcow.com.
And you can find more of Corey and I's work on leylinescomic.com and mocopress.com. And if you've enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to support what we do because you're a fantastic and amazing person, please go to Patreon and become a backer there. It's just patreon.com/mocopress, spelled with a K. So thank you very much and good night. A special announcement for those of you in Washington State. Corey and I will be at Emerald City Comic Con next weekend, the 28th, 29th, and 30th of March. Our artist alley table is JJ12 on the TCC Level 3 of the building. A little hard to find, but we promise to make it worth your while. Please come by, check out our merch, get a free sketch, and most importantly, we will get to meet you, which is always the most incredible part of a convention. So thank you so much, and we cannot wait to see you. Music for this episode was created by Reasoner. You can find more of his work at reasoner.newgrounds.com.